This is an interview with Mr. Philip J. McClure for the Youngstown University Oral History Project by David Arnn at the Naval Reserve Center, 315 East Laclede, Youngstown, Ohio, March 19, 1976, at approximately 1:05 p.m. Mr. McClure, could you just basically start this interview by giving me an idea of your personal background, where you were born, brought up, educated?
Well, I was reared in Struthers, and of course educated in the Struthers school system. And well, I spent practically all my life in Struthers other than the fact of going into service, that is full time.
When you went to the Struthers High School?
Yes.
Is that right? You graduated from Struthers?
Yes, right.
I see. When did you go into the military service?
In 1943.
You joined up in the Army?
Well, I was to be drafted, so rather than wait around being drafted, I just went ahead, as soon as I got out of high school, went ahead and joined up and went in.
I see. You joined the Army at that time?
Yes.
I see. Was this, did you join all yourself? Did a lot of people join with you that day, your classmates or anything?
At that time, no, I had a twin brother, and he and I and another friend went in together.
I see. You all joined the Army, did you? Or?
Yes, we all went into the Army.
I see. Was that right here in Youngstown, or did you have to go someplace else?
No, I was in Youngstown. We went through up here at the Army, the old Army up there on Rand Avenue.
I see. I see. You say your brother and a friend joined. Did you go off to training together? Is that it?
Well, yes. We went in, we were inducted through Fort Hays in Columbus. And from there, we were shipped out to California. And, of course, we worked together in the same office. And the one friend, of course, got transferred. But my brother and I stayed together all through service.
Oh, I see. What outfit were you assigned to?
Well, I was assigned to artillery. We were in the anti-aircraft artillery. And that's what we trained at in California.
Where was this in California?
Well, we were in Camp Hahn and the subcamp of Camp Irwin.
Where is this?
Well, it's right outside of Riverside, California. Matter of fact, right across the highway from March Field, which was an Air Force base at the time.
March Air Force Base. How long was this training at the time? It was during the wars. And,
well, we had a 16-week training program that we had to go through, and then that was in our basic. And then we went from there into our advanced training and finished up. Well, we were afraid we'd come to the east, but we finished up down in Louisiana.
I see. I see. What units were you assigned to then?
Well, we were assigned to the 125th AAA Gun Battalion, which is where Magnolia had been.
And then did you get shipped overseas? Or?
No, we left. We were down in Louisiana finishing our training there, and then we went up to Edwards, Massachusetts. And we were there waiting to be shipped out. And, well, as a matter of fact, we had to go, and they had a date, I forget now the date that they had assigned for us, and then we were pulled back off of it and given furloughs. And then sent back, and we left from right down, let's see now, in Boston.
What did you do? Did you go home on that furlough? Or?
Yeah, we went home.
So you did get shipped overseas?
Oh, yeah.
Now, where'd you go when you were in?
Well, when we first got over there, we went into England, and we went to a camp they called Blackshamore. And we were there primarily to draw our equipment. And then we convoyed down through England to, down around Dymchurch, Folkestone, in the town area there, and we were in what they called Hell's Kitchen. At that time, this was the buzz bomb blitz of London, and of course we were in that line of defense, and defending London against it.
I see. How long did you serve over there?
You mean overseas?
Yeah.
In the entirety? Close to 3 years, lacking a few months of being 3 years.
And they took you over there by convoy and a ship?
No, we didn't go by convoy. We went by just one troop ship.
Just one troop ship?
Yeah. Matter of fact, when we left, we had a convoy, or an escort, I should say, part of the way by a blimp.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we did a zigzag trail,
uh-huh.
and we made a big arc. We went north, uh-huh. all the way north, and then come back around. It actually took 7 days, which would have normally taken 5 days, but because of the arc that we made. And at the time, like I said, we didn't have the escort at all.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Now, how were conditions aboard the troop ship? Do you remember?
Well,
were conditions pretty good, or...?
Yeah, I would say they were good, other than the fact that most of us being landlubbers, why we had problems trying to keep our land legs.
Uh-huh.
And quite a few of the fellows did get sick.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, one has spent most of the time down in the hole, and they would chase us out and make us get up on deck.
I see. Was it nice weather, cold, nasty?
It was nice weather going over. Yeah, because we left in the spring of the year.
I see. So, basically you served overseas in England the majority of the time?
No, we were only in England for about 3 or 4 months, I guess, and then we crossed the channel
uh-huh.
and went over to Cherbourg, France,
uh-huh.
and we set up a defense there against, well, of course, this is where part of the invasion was
uh-huh.
in Cherbourg. And we had left there, and we set up a defense there for Cherbourg itself
uh-huh.
Against the Germans. Then we were only there, I think, about 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we convoyed clear up into Belgium.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we were still battling the buzz bombs at that
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
This was our primary battle, of course, but... Then we were up in Holland and Belgium probably the rest of our stay over there
mm-hmm.
until the war ended.
I see. So really the majority of the action that you did see over there was the buzz bomb?
Right, buzz bomb. Well, except when the Germans broke through there in what they call the Battle of the Bulge, we
uh-huh.
were taken out of Belgium
uh-huh.
and sent down to the area, and we were set up then as anti-tank.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the 90mm gun, of course, being utilized for that purpose. And, of course, I was a radar man myself, and we were stuck out on OP, observation post,
uh-huh.
with the bazooka and grenade, etc.
Did you see any tanks when you were down there?
Well, not really. One I seen was a battle just up the road, and of course we waited in anticipation for the battle to come our way, but it never did. It just seemed to linger up just ahead of us, and it never did come down.
I see. They kind of stopped them before it got down your way.
Well, evidently some of our own troops were up there at the time.
I see.
But there was quite a battle going on, and of course, according to our liaison officer, with our unit, we were wiped out as far as First Army Headquarters was concerned.
But actually, you never got into the...
Not into that type.
Uh-huh.
Our biggest was the buzz bomb.
I see. Now, when the war was over, did you come right home, or did they leave you there for a while, or...?
No, when the war was over, of course, we hadn't had that much time overseas at the time.
Uh-huh.
So what they did, they used us, sent us back to the redeployment camps, and used us as military police.
Oh.
For the troops that were being processed through mm-hmm. the redeployment camp back to home station.
I see.
And we spent a considerable amount of time in Camp St. Louis. And it was one, I think, the one we were in. I was in two of them, and I don't remember the other one now,
mm-hmm.
but one St. Louis.
I see. So what your main job was, directing traffic? Or?
Well, directing traffic, helping the fellows out that were being processed through these camps.
I see. So when did you actually get a chance to come back to?
Well, then we came back in February of 46. Of course, they had disbanded our unit, and most of our fellows, the older ones, especially the older fellows, were sent back home. Before we were,
mm-hmm.
and we did come back as a unit, and of course took our the designated, unit designation to Washington there where it was deactivated.
I see.
But we were brought back through Indiantown Gap Military Reservation where we were processed and discharged.
Indiantown Gap?
Yeah, Military Reservation.
Where was that?
That's over near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
I see. And so you were processed for a discharge at that time?
Right.
I see. So what did you do?
Well, what I did then, I stayed in the reserves. In other words, I was discharged one day from the Army and picked up the next day and went in the reserve.
Uh-huh.
And then when I came home, of course, I looked for a unit, an active unit that was anti-aircraft, what I was trained in, and there weren't any available here in this area at the time.
Uh-huh.
So I stayed in the inactive reserves for a period of 3 years, for which I signed up, and then I let my time lapse from February until April when I picked up again in the reserves. And I went down here and tried to get back into some active unit, but here again I leaned towards aircraft and the anti-aircraft, and there was still nothing available. So I just stayed in on the inactive status until 1951 when the National Guard started organizing an anti-aircraft unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is when I transferred over into the National Guard then.
I see. So actually you were a member of the Army Reserve until 51, even though you were inactive, is
right,
that correct?
Right. Uh-huh.
I see. Now what kind of a unit were you attached to, and where was this and when you came back right after the war?
You mean on an inactive
yeah.
status? You really weren't attached to any unit. You were just in the active reserve, or the inactive reserve corps.
I see.
And it was actually in a control group out of St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh, I see. So you weren't required to drill or any of that?
No, time? Right. There was no requirement.
But does that time count as far as...
longevity.
Longevity.
Right.
But you didn't get any retirement points?
No, there. There's no retirement points for it.
I see. So actually, in the Army, when you were a member of the Army Reserve, you never did participate in any...
No, like I said, I was looking for something to my liking that they didn't have here.
Okay, was there anything anywhere around? Did they ask you to go someplace else to drill upon?
Well, no, they tried to get me to come down into the reserve units they had here.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, like I said, I didn't particularly want to change my branch. I was interested in what I was in, so I wanted to stay in it.
I see. I see. So in 1951, the National Guard in Ohio... came out with an anti-aircraft
right.
Mm-hmm. I see. What kind of a unit was this at that time?
Well, it was a 90-millimeter unit,
uh-huh.
and of course this is what I had trained and spent all my time overseas with.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I was interested in getting into.
I see. That was here in
Youngstown.
In Youngstown. Okay. Now, what was your job in that unit?
Well, when I first went in, during the period of activation, they started with a headquarters battery then, and of course I went into that, and we really had nothing. We just trained as a unit,
mm-hmm.
Being that we were just being activated. And I think I was only in headquarters perhaps for a period of 3 months,
uh-huh.
when they started a battery, one of the line batteries, and of course then this is what I wanted to get into.
Uh-huh.
And this was a battery then, and so I went into that and served as the CRO, which is the chief radar operator.
I see. What was your rank at that time?
At that time, I came in as a sergeant, uh-huh. E5.
E5?
Yeah.
I see.
Of course, they didn't have that rating then. They still just sergeants.
Uh-huh. Now, as a sergeant, do you remember how much you made pay-wise or anything at that time?
No, I don't.
I see. How many people were in this company at that time?
When we first started?
Yeah.
Oh, it was approximately, I would say, around 49 members.
No, that was just of the aircraft?
Any aircraft. No, that's one battery.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Now, how many units were assigned here in Youngstown in the National Guard at that time? Do you happen to remember that?
Well, yes, it was, they had a couple other troops that were already here. As a matter of fact, some of them were called out and went into Korea.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember the unit's designation, but I think there were two units at the time were in the armory.
Yeah.
And they were called out and did go to Korea. And when they formed ours, and they formed the headquarters, and then they formed the A battery, which made two units in the Army at that time.
I see. Now, you all drilled down at the Christian Armory, is that it?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Did you? When did you drill when you first started?
Well, we used to drill one night a week.
Uh-huh.
And usually it was on a Thursday night. Each unit had their own night for uh-huh. drilling. It was a 4-hour drill.
Uh-huh.
And it was a 48 drills uh-huh. per year.
I see. Now, how did the coordination work there? Did you have an officer in charge or a commanding officer?
Well, each unit had their own company or battery commander.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, he had his own officers. We were broken down into sections. You had your range section and your gun section.
Uh-huh.
And he had an officer who was in charge of each of these sections.
I see.
And then, of course, your section sergeants
uh-huh.
were in charge of the individual. We had a height finder section and a radar section in mm-hmm. the range section at that time. Of course, I was in charge of the radar section.
I see. So about how many officers were,
Well, there was usually about 4 officers in a company or in a battery, because you had your battery commander, your executive officer, and your range officer and gun officer.
I see. What was the senior officer there?
He was a captain.
A captain. Mm-hmm. I see. Now, who did he report to? Do you know?
Well, we had a battalion commander
uh-huh.
At that time. Of course, we had formed another unit up in Warren,
mm-hmm.
and we also had another unit down in Alliance.
I see.
See, so we had 2 units here and 2 other batteries, one in Warren, one in Alliance.
I see. Now, who was the battalion commander, or what was he?
Well, when we originally formed, it was Colonel Lake,
uh-huh.
Lieutenant Colonel Ben Lake, and he was with us probably maybe. He was the one that was instrumental in getting the unit formed. He was mm-hmm. from up around in Warren. And he didn't... Well, he wasn't with us too terribly long, about a year, year and a half at the most.
Uh-huh.
And I think he had a health problem, he had to get out.
I see.
So then the unit commander was Major Boyer. He became the battalion commander.
Uh-huh.
And of course, there's been, I mean, I could go down the line and
sure.
give you a succession if this is what you want.
Well, I mean, if you happen to remember it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember all of them.
Uh-huh.
Colonel Lake was the original. And of course, Major Boyer followed him. And then he left. He went to Florida. He was working with the Veterans Administration.
Uh-huh.
So he had to leave and go to Florida. So then Major Frank
mm-hmm.
then became the battalion commander.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, got promoted to a lieutenant colonel. And he was with the unit about 3 years. And then he was followed by Colonel Cook,
mm-hmm.
who worked in the battalion. He came in the battalion as the adjutant when it was originally formed.
That's Colonel Howard Cook?
Yes, and worked his way up to the battalion commander,
uh-huh.
which I thought was very nice. And then followed Colonel Cook, they brought a Colonel Davis in from Columbus area,
uh-huh.
and he wasn't with us too long, and then about a year and a half, and he was relieved by Colonel Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
And then following Colonel Schwartz was Colonel Landers, Colonel Landers.
Mm-hmm.
And then following him, which we have now as our present commander, is Colonel Connors.
I see. Now, these officers, they weren't all from the local area, as you mentioned. How was an officer selected for the command, let's say? Do you know?
I wouldn't say completely. Usually it depends in a state. You know, they have their various ranks
uh-huh.
who are, of course, governed by this, how much time they've had in grade.
Sure.
And they try to get them promoted accordingly.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes some of them are pretty hot as far as time and grade, and they've got to get promoted or get out. They
nice.
Get caught on this ROPA deal. So this is how we caught 2 of them, really, this way.
Mm-hmm.
But the others were ones that were the ones that were promoted right through the ranks within our own battalion.
Oh, I see.
So we've had, not like Colonel Landers, although he was from Warren, he's still within our vicinity.
Uh-huh.
But Colonel Davis and Colonel Schwartz and our present commander, Colonel Connors, are all from down in Columbus area.
Right? I see. Now they have to drive all the way up here?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry about Colonel Connors. He's from Toledo area.
Uh-huh. He drives all the way up here for
a weekend, yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, there's facilities down at the Army for him to stay overnight, or?
Yes, we do have, they set up an apartment there. They used to have a custodian
mm-hmm.
that lived in the Armory.
I see.
And of course, he's gone now, and they do have a custodian, but the custodian lives in his own home.
I see.
So that apartment, of course, has been renovated and used for the for some of our officers who are from out of town and do come in and stay overnight.
I see. Now, what's the relationship, let's say, with the commanders of the units, with the active staff there, the people that are all the time?
All right. From what I've seen and know, it's been a very good relationship.
Uh-huh.
Even though they're from out of town, they spend a lot of time on the telephone talking and keeping abreast of what's going on.
Sure.
And of course, they are sent all the publications the unit puts out, and here again, they're kept abreast of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that they, when they come to drill, they don't come cold. They know what's going on.
I see. Now, the people that the civilian people that are 5 days a week.
Yeah.
Now, are these people members of units that are attached?
Yes, they have to be in order to hold a job.
I see.
They must be a member of the unit in order to hold a job there.
Now, do they have to be a member of the unit that they're supporting, or can they be a member of any unit?
No, they have to be a member of the unit they are supporting.
I see. Now, but how many are there down there right now? Do you know?
No, offhand, I would say about 12, 15.
I see.
Of course, now this includes the people who work up at the OMS shop who do the maintenance work on vehicles.
I see. There's, and where is that?
That's up on Gypsy Lane, off Belmont.
I see. Now, is that just for these units that are here, or for any in this area?
No, that's just for the units that belong here.
I see. Now, do you have your own equipment with you at all the time, or do you have to go draw your own equipment?
No, our most of our equipment is issued to us. Except when maybe when we go to camp, some requirements are put on us that some equipment we don't have, then of course we draw it.
I see. So basically, you have all the things that you need to train on all the time?
Most of the time, yes.
Okay. Now, when you go, when you do train, let's say on an average weekend at the time, could you just give me an idea of your schedule? What
all right,
happens?
Now, you're talking about present now.
Presently,
all right,
yeah.
Okay. Before we get into this,
may I say
this, that the 90 millimeter units were phased out here back in 1964 and 65,
okay.
And we were changed to automatic weapons, 40 millimeter guns, and we only remained that for 2 years, and then we changed over to military police, for which we are now.
Okay. Jimmy, let me back up and say, could you give me an idea of what you did when you, had guns and stuff like that, and what you have now?
Well, when we had guns, of course, we had something to work with, something to train on. And there was no problem, really, as far as training is concerned. Now, we have the military police, and it's a little bit different than what it was when you had something to work with.
Uh-huh.
Here, you're working with other parts of the armory. Army, when you're out running traffic control, search and seizure sort of thing, you're not actually, you don't have anything really to work with except other people.
Uh-huh.
You don't have your own equipment here.
Uh-huh.
So this is the type of thing you're getting into now with military police.
I see.
And it's been harder to train military police than it was to train as artillery people.
I see.
Because it's harder to set up a training program. On weekends, we usually have classes, usually lasting an hour, maybe 2 hour classes, that'll last for maybe half the day or part of the day, and then they do try to train some sort of practical exercise to go along with this.
Mm-hmm.
And here again, it's kind of hard to set it up. Now, we have a unit in Warren that goes out and works out at Lordstown with the security force out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have our Youngstown unit now is under a different, what they call a different training program.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to go out into the field where they're going to employ all these people to be used during the training day, rather than going to sit in on classrooms all, instruction all the time.
I see. Now, is this classroom training, in your opinion, is it viable, necessary?
I don't really think so. I think the individual himself gains more by being out doing something by sitting in the classroom listening.
I see.
the average individual, I think, is quick to grasp things, and if you take them out in the field without going into a lengthy explanation of it, by showing them what they are to do, they can do it and grasp it much quicker than I can, than sitting in listening to a class.
I see. So you've changed over basically from your original radar.
Yeah.
MOS type thing to a to one of the military police.
Military police, yeah.
What is your job at the present?
Well, right now I'm the operations sergeant. I work in the operations section, of course. My job is in training, and then when we go to camp, working with the provost marshal, checking, as I would say, traffic, making recommendations to the provost marshal to maybe take care of some sort of traffic congestion, reviewing all his reports and things and making these recommendations to him. But, of course, we don't get involved too much here at the armory on this because our type of training doesn't get into this. So what I get into primarily is working with the training schedule, seeing that the people who are responsible for the training, for the classes, get it, and also that to help them in any training aids that are available for them, and making sure the classes are as interesting as possible.
I see. Now, who do you report to?
Well, normally in the mornings we have our formation. I report to the detachment, headquarters detachment is what we are. And then, of course, after our formation, we go into the sectionals, and then I'm responsible to the ES3. He's in charge of the plan and training.
I see. Now, how many people are presently assigned to, let's say, the military battalion headquarters?
The headquarters detachment itself?
Yeah.
All right, there's approximately 55 people.
Okay, now down to the section, let's say. How's this divided? Evenly,
well,
or?
No. It depends on what your TOE, your table organization equipment. Tells you. This tells you how many people are in each section, what each rank will be, and et cetera. This is the Bible by which we have to go by. And this is how these people are placed. But they are, as I said before, once they come and have their formation, their roll call, then they go into the section. They're responsible to that section. One section may have maybe only two or three men. Or another section may have 14 or 15.
I see.
It depends on what the section in itself. You have S1, S2, S3, and S4 section. And then you have a commo section. You have an augmented mess section. You have a personnel section. So you have people in all these sections.
I see. Now, you say you've got a table of organization, et cetera. How well has it been manned in the recent, in other words, what are you manned at the present time?
Well,
are you fully manned? Is there
no? Right now, we're under strength.
I see.
Because of the 6-year obligators are now starting to get out, and of course, this is where we're starting to lose people.
I see. I think we're all under that.
Yeah, right. We're all getting into that problem.
Let me ask you this: has it recruiting for the National Guard? Has it always has been a problem? Is it fairly fruitful?
No, not really. It's not really always been a problem. As a matter of fact, at one time, we used to have a waiting list. But since the draft has ceased, of course, this waiting list has likewise ceased.
Yeah.
Our biggest thing now is to getting back to what was when I first got into the Guard. You get out and recruit people who are and want to be into it. And this is the ones that we're getting now, people who really want to get into it. We have a full-time recruiter in our unit. He's been working in the Cleveland area. He's coming back, and he'll be working in the Youngstown area in the next couple of weeks. But he took a unit up, one of our units, which is in Cleveland. They were something like 50-some people under strength. And he brought it up to within two of their full strength. Just one man. And of course, this is his job. He's employed by the state as a full-time recruiter, and this is what he does.
Now, you only accept veterans, is that it?
No.
You accept...
No, we accept them. Any.
Now, how does this guy get trained? Let's say any guy walking in off the street.
Well, we're running into a problem training-wise now. They had it set up, and I don't know whether you people come out of that or not. Now, the Army Reserve, National Guard, of course, would send their people to 6 months active duty training. This would be their basic. But now this has been cut down to 4 months. But this is where they get their basic training, which we don't have to teach them and train them. So right. Before, we used to have to do this, but we don't anymore. But they've got such a backlog on this now that it's hard. We've had, we have a female, or an EW, I guess they call them now, that's been waiting, and she goes on the 27th of March in to training, finally. She's been waiting now for a period, well, it's been almost a year to get in.
But she goes to 4 months, or 4 months active duty training.
Yeah.
Now she's taught the basics and plus some kind of a technical training.
Yeah. Well, see, they're assigned an MOS and or job title, and then they will go do their basic, and then they will train some in this job title that they're put in.
Then they return in a specific billet assignment. Is that it?
Then they return back to the unit in the a certain MOS that they're to fulfill when they come back, right?
But the majority you're recruiting, in other words, do you get the majority from veterans, picking them back up in the...
Well, I would say now we're getting into this. But up until now, no. Most of our people are just, even some, we still have a few that we get in just coming out of high school.
I see. What, in your own opinion, what makes somebody join the National Guard?
Well, there are varied reasons why, and of course, one of the big selling points today, I think, is the money end, that they're trying to make it so attractive for the people as a part-time job that you just can't beat it.
I see.
But this is one of the big attractions. But as far as there's other varied reasons, probably some wanted because. It's a diversion for them. Others get into it because they're interested in it. And it's hard to say what would be the biggest reason.
Now, you said there's a change, you know, there used to be a waiting list and everything. Do you think you're getting better quality people now than you did before?
No. The reason I say this, when the draft was on, we got our... level of education was high. And of course, now that this has the draft has dropped, and these fellows are getting out, the people we're getting in, their intelligence isn't that high, so it's starting to drop.
Now, why would you say somebody might join the National Guard over the Army Reserve?
Well, the National Guard has become the number one reserve force today. And the Army Reserve has taken a second, I think. Because, well, you serve a twofold purpose. One, you're one of the state organization, and you are called out for varied things as trucker strike, riots, disturbances, emergencies, be it like a flood, fire, things of this nature. So you're utilized in twofold. You're trained as an Army man and to be utilized as a military person, but you're also trained to be utilized for the secondary. And we've been used quite a bit for the secondary purpose lately.
Would you think they're becoming a glorified policeman or something like that, per se?
No, I don't think they're trying to take away from the police. No, I don't think that's... that's the full intent.
I see.
It's only as a force to be used in a disaster of some kind, or as an emergency.
I see. Now, getting back to your main reason, why did you join the?
Well, I got into the Guard simply because they were forming the unit that I was interested in at the time. When I come out of service, I wanted to stay in it and keep abreast of what was going on, and I knew if I didn't, that I would lose out. And then when the National Guard opened up the artillery, and I got into it, and I became more and more interested in it, and as the years went by, I just found that I truthfully enjoyed it.
I see. Now, how does your family feel about this?
Well, my wife, of course, was, at first she was kind of reluctant about it, but she was willing to go along with me on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I will say at times it conflicted, but we always seem to work it out. As far as my children is concerned, they don't know any different because they've grown up with me in the guard.
How does, let me ask you this. How do you feel about your 2-week training program? Do you think this is a valuable time? Do you look forward to it, or is it kind
you mean,
of...
Yeah, yes, I do. Because really, you're putting to work all the learning and training you have done during the year.
Uh-huh.
And this is the purpose of your AT period.
Mm-hmm.
And I do look forward to it. This year I'm looking forward to it more so than perhaps in the past years because we're getting into some field problems that we haven't had too much of an opportunity to get into.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you find that people enjoy these time away from home kind of like just a kind of a change of pace too?
Yeah, I think so. It is a diversion. It just mm-hmm. is, the weekend is a diversion for you.
Uh-huh.
Really, of course, I think here again too that you've got to be a sort of certain type of an individual who can conform to it to be able to bend with it, because there's a change. There's no question about it. The military is different from civilian, and you've got to be able to change and go with it.
I see. How do your family feel about this?
Well, they've accepted it, and there's been no qualms as far as. My family's concerned.
Where do you usually go in your 2 weeks?
Well, we used to go to Camp Perry, Ohio, but now in the last 4 or 5 years, this has changed. Well, simply because of our change in structure,
sure.
Going from artillery, where we used to fire guns out over the lake was no problem, but we're going into MPs, and Camp Perry is just a small camp. It could not, we could send one platoon of men up there, and that would cover the camp. We're now, we went to Grayling 1 year and to Knox, and some of our units have gone to Camp Pickett, Virginia, Savannah Depot, which is a like a warehouse, big warehouse place where they're a guard company. They go out and guard. This is their primary purpose. And then last year, some of our units went up to Camp McCoy, Wisconsin. And that's where our unit is going this year.
I see. Overall, if you had a choice to do it again, do you think you...
As a young man, yes, most definitely.
Uh-huh. I mean, you'd do it the same way? You wouldn't
would.
I've talked to some people that possibly thought they may have stayed on active duty, possibly. Even.
Well, I had that opportunity. One of my officers tried to talk me into it, and... Well, after being in for almost 3 years, I wanted to get out for a while, and of course, I don't know what to say, what I would have really done then.
Now, is there something I might have overlooked and forgotten to ask you you might like to add in there?
Not that I can think of.
One last question I'd like to ask you would be, what do you see as the future of the reserve, specifically the Guard? Is it look good, bad?
Well, as far as manpower is concerned, I look for it to be a real problem. Of course, they're getting more and more women into it. I see a lot of changes having to be made over the years. I suppose this would not only apply to the Guard, but probably to any branch of service where they've got women coming in now. And a real problem there is being able to work with the women. I think a man has looked, some of the men, I won't say all of them, some of them looked on women as a sex symbol. And of course here again they're invading the a man's domain that's been in existence for 100 and some years. And it's going to be hard for those women coming in to accept some of the things that the men do. And it's going to be hard for the men to accept the women into the units and learn to have to live with them and work with them. So this, I really feel this is going to be a real big problem, being able to get the problem so that they can go together and work towards one common goal, and being able to retain these people in the Guard, or Reserve, or Naval Reserve. This is going to be their real problem.
Well, thank you very much. Enjoyed talking with you this afternoon.
Thank you.